Thank you for joining us here today on this edition of The Legal Dose. My name is Brandon Pierce, and today I am joined by Grant Christensen, a professor here at Charlotte School of Law. How are you doing today, Professor Christensen?
I'm doing real well, thank you.
Good. I'd like to get started out just by telling us a little about your journey through the legal field, how you arrived to be a professor here at Charlotte School of Law.
Okay, so when I finished law school, my first job after law school is I went in-house at Target Corporation. So I finished law school and moved to the wild north of Minnesota. And I worked there in at Target for a number of years. When I finished my time at Target, I went then to a mid-sized firm where I was a securities fraud litigator. When I finished my... Somewhere at that point, I decided that it was time to go back to school. And then I did an LLM in Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy. So after working in the corporate world for a number of years, I stopped corporate law and I did a 1-year degree specifically in American Indian Law, Federal Indian Law at the University of Arizona. And when I came out of the University of Arizona, I took a job as an adjunct professor at the University of Toledo. Then I was a visiting professor for about a year at the University of Oregon. Then I took a Fulbright with the U.S. State Department to Lithuania, and I lived in Eastern Europe for about a year. And then I started here at Charlotte. And so that's the career path, although there are little bits and pieces there that are Indian related. So when I was in law school, I did an Indian law summer semester. So I did a semester of law school over the summer offered at Lewis and Clark. And that was my first exposure to Indian law. I did that at the Bonneville Power Authority. I worked at BPA specifically on procuring water rights or our federal trust relationship with tribes in the Pacific Northwest. And then coming out after, obviously, the LLM was in Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy. But then when I went to Lithuania, it was on a project related to Native tribes. So it was specifically looking at the U.S. treaty relationship with the Baltics. They were relatively new countries. They'd been occupied by the Soviet Union for 70 or so years before they received independence. And I was asking, could we learn anything from the treaty relationship we had with the Baltic states that we could apply to the treaty relationship with tribes, where we'd had treaties that were signed and then long ago forgotten. And then now in this, you know, this new kind of current civil rights era, tribes are rediscovering these promises and trying to enforce them. And so there was a kind of parallel there between Native communities and Eastern Europe. And then when I came back and I started being a professor, in addition to teaching in the classroom, I've served as an appellate judge for the Havasupai Nation, which is a tribe on the floor of the Grand Canyon. And so I've been able to remain involved in Indian issues throughout that career.
Okay, and so you said you learned all this about Indian law, and it kind of you learned some things that you didn't know before. In getting all that information, what have you found to be some of the misconceptions or facts that people really don't know about Indian law?
So we could do this for an hour, right? I mean, we could do this for days. This is why there's an Indian law class. Because almost everything that you learn in law school, almost everything that you know about Indians is different when you put it in the context of, or so almost everything you know about the law is different when you put it in the context of American Indians. So if, for example, we are guaranteed you would think that no government could establish religion. Right, that's one of those guarantees that's there in the First Amendment. But people don't understand that the way the Constitution and the Bill of Rights works is it was an incorporation doctrine. So when the states signed up and the states ratified the document, that conferred the rights, right, both the rights on the citizens and the prohibitions from the state. But tribes have never ratified that document. So we have these holes all over the country where the document itself, your constitutional rights, don't apply in the same way. Now, some of them have been extended by Congress, but for example, there are tribes out there that have established religion that say that you can't be buried in our cemetery, or that you can't own property, or that you're not entitled to welfare or healthcare benefits unless you're Catholic, right? And so persons of different religious beliefs aren't able to express those beliefs on the reservation. There are some reservations that have to choose, you know, if your father is a member, you're a member. But if your mother is a member, you're not a member. Or sorry, if your father is enrolled, then you're enrolled. If your mother is not enrolled, then it only passes, or membership in the tribe passes through the father's lineage. So even though you learn the language and you live on the reservation because mom is a member, you're never eligible to join. So an open discrimination on the basis of gender. With Indian children, you know, we learn in family law that ordinarily in the US you can only have two parents, right? And if one parent, if you have a step parent and they want to take and assert parental rights over you, one of your biological parents has to give up their rights because you can only ever have two legal parents. Except under the Indian Child Welfare Act, the tribe can assert parental rights on your behalf. So there are times when you can have a third legal parent. The government of the tribe can assert parental rights, you know, essentially in place of or over the child. If North Carolina bans casino gaming, yet an Indian tribe can still build a casino on its own lands. All of these areas where the law just works differently when you're dealing with American Indian people.
Okay, and what international conventions, if any, have played a role in relations between Native Americans and in the United States?
So there are a number of different pieces of international law that govern, although the United States isn't always great about signing up or being obligated to all of those bits of international law. While we were a holdout under the Bush administration, President Obama made an important announcement early in his presidency that the United States would agree to be bound essentially by UNDRIP, the United Nations Convention on the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And so there is, you know, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is essentially the kind of big founding UN document that says we believe our member states, you know, should in their relations with native people respect these sets of rights. And they include binding rights to consultation, respect for language, religion, and culture. I mean, there's more than that. We would have a whole class just on what UNDRIP requires. There are other bits of international law that directly relate to how governments should work with their native populations, many of which the US doesn't necessarily sign up to. So the ILO, the International Labour Organization, has Convention 169, which governs labor disputes or rights between native workers and both their employers and governments, specifically set out for indigenous peoples. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has taken a lead in going ahead and creating a treaty regime and a judicial body that can hear claims brought by native peoples against the governments themselves. Every 2 to 3 years, each state of the United Nations has to go through a review of its human rights practices. Always, the United States human rights practices towards its native peoples are brought up in questions and are a part of that report. So there's an annual meeting every year in New York in May and in Geneva over the summer on international law, the United Nations and native peoples, and the United States takes part in each of those kind of meetings of international bodies. So there are a number of ways in which international law and international norms exist to go ahead and work with tribes. But we are still a laggard in the application of international law to native peoples.
And I want to go back to the people who live in these Indian communities. What are some of the challenges, if any, that they face? You were speaking about the enrollment process and how that could be gender-based discrimination. What challenges are in these communities are being confronted within the members living there?
Well, it's every tribe has its own culture, and to be respectful of the culture means that the government takes a hands-off position, essentially on tribes get to decide their own membership. So There are some enrollment concerns that you find in different parts of the country, especially involving casinos. So each tribal community is different. We have 566 federally recognized tribes today. Interior has been on a pace of about 1 a year, and they have a backlog of somewhere between 40 and 60 applications where they still haven't given a yes/no answer. So we could look at that ultimate number being over 600 potentially. With 566 federally recognized tribes, it's really difficult to say anything about Indian country that, uniformly people are experiencing one kind of difficulty. So there are some tribes that are just literally a handful of clans. We're talking about 30 people or fewer in terms of members. There are some tribes whose membership numbers into the hundreds of thousands. There are tribes with no land base, or tribes with just 10 acres, 40 acres of land, where it's very difficult for them to act truly as a nation when we're talking about something that's a piece of property the size of a large high school. There are other tribes like the Navajo Nation, who, if it was a state, would be larger than 11 of our existing states. It would be just slightly smaller than the state of West Virginia. And so when we're talking about Indian country, we want to be careful about making any kind of generalization. So it's hard for me to say that Native peoples are always seeking or they face these kind of challenges. Different tribes present different challenges. So, if you're a gaming tribe, under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, a quarter of profits are distributed, either spent on behalf of the tribe or distributed directly to members. In those tribes, the ones that have casinos that are very successful, and it's important to recognize that it's a small number of tribes. With 566 federally recognized tribes, no more than between 30 and 50 of them could be considered large-scale gamers. Whether others have a bingo parlor or a small casino, it doesn't generate large amounts of money. So we're talking about a small handful of very wealthy tribes. Those tribes have had some disputes over enrollment, because if they have a smaller membership, then the benefits of the casino are shared among a smaller number of people, so everyone gets more money. And so in those tribes, one of the current issues really facing Indian country is a dispute over membership, in that one part of the tribe, in not everywhere, but in places, is moving to try to disenroll some of its members, so that the other members, the ones that remain members of the tribe, will get a larger cut of the revenues of the casino. And so that is something that even internally, tribal governments do to tribal individuals, and that, ideally, the Indian Civil Rights Act exists to try to kind of help, or to provide a remedy to those individuals. But it's an uphill battle because of the way the act is written.
And considering that the law is always changing and trends within society, if you could paint a picture of what Indian country or Indian law would be 10 years from now, what would that look like?
Well, I know what I would like it to look like, and that's a little different than maybe what it will look like. So, ever since we have a number of different eras of Indian history. Indian law can kind of be parceled up, and depending on how you kind of group it, anywhere from like 3 to 8 different periods as federal policy towards tribes have changed. We're in what a lot of scholars have called now a self-determination kind of era, where tribes are finally being handed back some of the things that the federal government has traditionally done for them in a way that is very empowering. So, 10 years from now, I hope what Indian law looks like is that tribes have continued to take advantage of that opportunity given to them by the government to hand back some of their powers, things that government does for them, so that tribes start to make their own decisions, running police forces, running schools, running hospitals. And so they really do achieve or continue along this path of self-determination.
If there's a student out there who is interested and wants to get involved as well, what would be the first step you recommend they take to getting within that, going in that direction in the
Sure.
law?
So, well, for our students here at Charlotte, this year we've started a NALSA, a Native American Law Student Association. And so getting involved with the student organization is probably a good first step, because they will hopefully have, speakers, will talk about how to get a job in Indian country, partnering with CPD, right? Just raising issues in Indian country here on campus. Getting involved with the organization that does that is a good kind of first step. I teach an Indian law class. It'll be offered again. It was offered last spring. It's offered again next spring. So the Indian law class is a good way to get some of the basic, like the legal tenets, right? To read those big Indian law cases that come about. And so the Indian law class is also good. And then ultimately, there are jobs in Indian country, and that's something that students maybe need to hear more often. They're not always in, the Charlottes or the New Yorks or the Chicagos or the DCs. They're in places where people need legal services, but a lot of times those jobs are subsidized by the federal government, so they pay a little better than you might expect, even though you have to live in a place that has a fair degree of remoteness. And so,
Okay, well, thank you, Professor Christensen, for those tips to potential students who want to get involved. And thank you for your time today. We've talked a lot about Indian law and your experience in that field, and I think you definitely have the passion for that, and hopefully that will show through and get other individuals involved so they can begin to learn about the area of Indian law and become an advocate for Indian country as well. So
Well, thank you, Brandon.
this concludes our edition of The Legal Dose. Thank you, and join us next time.